cliche after cliche.
Good morning. Welcome to the February 5th meeting of Capital Investments Committee. And the first item on the agenda today is to a continuation of the Society of American Engineers giving their report card. And today we're going to find out about drinking water. Mr. Spihola.
Madam Chair, Committee, good morning. Thank you for having us back. Today we'll finish up with drinking water and wastewater. Allison Wheeler was going to present the wastewater, but unfortunately she had a work commitment and she wasn't able to. So Dennis Martinson will do both drinking water and water.
Very good. Mr. Martinson.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Just a comment. Unfortunately, Allison couldn't be here, but I teach part-time at the university. We have about 30% of our students today in the College of Science and Engineering are female. I thought I would interject that. We have quite a few members of our American Society of Civil Engineers Minnesota section who are also female. So just wanted to mention that.
Well, I knew that there were some because I know the one of the engineers in Duluth. It was a former student of mine from Duluth Central, Phil B. Williams, and I think it's good to have them on the agenda, if it's possible. And she did sit here very patiently that
right.
day, and so I know what she looks like. So I know there's two anyway,
right.
And I'll trust your words.
Okay. I can assure you there are many more.
And there are many more that are coming from the kids that participate in the K-12 STEM programs that come and offer testimony in K-12 Finance Committee.
Right.
We've seen many young women that aspire right. to becoming engineers.
I have all daughters, and my oldest granddaughter is a mechanical engineer, so I'm very proud that I did get one.
Very
second
good.
Generation. Anyway, we'll start with the drinking water, if I can, Madam Chair. Drinking water, excuse me, is a portion of our infrastructure that's not seen generally by the public because it's out of sight, although you may have noticed in the news in the last couple of days there was a water main break in the south of the Ceasefire Lake, and that did get some publicity, and certainly the residents who had their basements flooded drinking water infrastructure was very visible in that sense. That's not how we like to see the visibility of our drinking water infrastructure, however.
Excuse me, Mr. Martinson.
Yes.
We're on, for the committee members, we're on page 21 of the pamphlet.
Okay.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some 4 or 5 Minnesotans obtain their drinking water from a public water supply, while the other 20% have private wells. And although Minnesotans are served by public drinking water supplies that is safe and consistently meets federal standards for water quality, our aging infrastructure and the increasing demand for funding to maintain these public water supplies resulted in, it was part of the reason that we had the grade of C- for the drinking water infrastructure in the state of Minnesota. Funding. The U.S. EPA estimates that over the next 20 years, the state of Minnesota will need $7.5 billion, that's with a B, dollars to fund improvements in our drinking water infrastructure in the state of Minnesota. The result of this significant need for future funding of our drinking water infrastructure may result in either delays needed to do these infrastructure improvements and or increasing fees or those citizens served by our public drinking water supplies. Many of those served by the public water supplies unfortunately have incomes below the median and therefore have a reduced ability to pay for these potential increased user fees. Minnesota prepares a drinking water project priority list for drinking water needs in the state of Minnesota. And in 2017, there was a 2-year increase of some 60% in the number of number of projects in dollars. It resulted in 330 projects at an estimated cost of $559 million over that two-year, the increase over that two-year period. One of the significant facts, excuse me, from this increase in the number of projects is that with cities with populations under 2,500 had 268 of those projects, or 81%, had an estimated cost of $300 million, or 54% of the dollars estimated for drinking water infrastructure projects. How do we raise the grade in drinking water? There's various ways to do that. One certainly would be increasing the drinking water revolving fund, encouraging more drinking water suppliers to utilize asset management. One of the difficulties, as was mentioned in some of the other infrastructure categories, was the difficulty of getting what we could consider extremely reliable. We had to extrapolate some data from those that do have asset management to those that do not. So having better asset management throughout the state would certainly help in our gathering information on which we base our infrastructure report card. The Safe Water Drinking Connection fee hasn't been raised since 2005. It was $5.21 at that time, and the Minnesota Health Department would like to see that, and those of us in the profession would also like to see that increase going forward. Educating the public on water quality issues through engagement and discussions on drinking water supplies would also be a plus. With that, we'd like to switch to wastewater, but before we do that, if you have any questions on drinking water, I'd be happy to try to answer those.
Okay. Mr. Martinson, so the 521, is that what we're paying now?
Right, that's a connection fee. That's everybody that's on a public water supply pays that fee over a 12-month period, and that's been in effect since 2001. A lot of that money goes to analysis, collection and analysis of water samples from drinking water supplies.
And when is the Department of Public Health planning on going for the 636?
My understanding is that that actually requires some legislative authorization to do that, and my understanding is that they have requested that, but it has not been approved in the past.
They requested through the governor?
I am not certain the exact process that that request took.
Ms. Dyson, can you help out? No. Okay. Does any legislator here know about this? Okay, we'll find out more later.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. In 2005, the rate was raised from 521 to 636. Since then, for the last three biennia, the Department of Health has had a budget change item to increase that fee. It has not ended up being approved as part of their budget. So the current fee is 636.
Okay.
The new fee, I'm not going to remember the exact number, but it's in the $9 range, and it is to both fully fund the testing of public drinking water supplies that is already being done, and to remove the dependence it has on federal funding, because right now we're taking money that could be going out as loans to cities and using it to pay for this drinking water testing.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. That's more clear now. Representative Juergens.
Representative
Erdoff.
She leans right.
Yes. Thank you. I'm just wondering is that a one-time fee per connection?
That's a per connection fee for a calendar year.
Oh, for each year.
Yes, right. Above all those that are on public drinking water supplies.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Please continue, Mr. Martins.
Wastewater, again, is one of those infrastructure areas that, you know, if your drain doesn't back up in the basement, as some of those experienced in Prior Lake due to the water main break, you don't think about wastewater collection and treatment as well like drinking water, because it's out of sight, out of mind until it doesn't work. Excuse me. We started out with the wastewater by looking at the number of facilities in the state, and I might just mention that there are more public drinking water supplies than there are wastewater, so these numbers would be greater with drinking water. Greater Minnesota in the 7-county metro area, we looked at it in that manner. The Twin Cities metropolitan area, about 3.3 million, outstate about 1.4 million, and approximately 900,000 residents could be classified as rural. Collection systems only and treatment plants, wastewater treatment plants, the total is 816 in the state. In the Twin Cities metropolitan area, there's 131 entities, cities, for example, primarily that have collection systems, but there's only 23 wastewater treatment plants in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, the 7-county area. And I might mention there's a little bit of the 7 counties still rural where some homeowners are on-site systems. In greater Minnesota, there's 685 total facilities. 556 of those are wastewater treatment plants. So the vast majority of collection systems have a dedicated treatment plant outstate, but in the metropolitan area, that is not the case. In greater Minnesota, the median household incomes are generally less than in the metropolitan area, and sometimes much less. As a result, there is a lesser ability to pay for wastewater collection and treatment costs as reflected in wastewater rates in greater Minnesota. The reason fees are generally higher and sometimes much higher in the in the area outside the Twin Cities metropolitan area is due to economies of scale in the metro area where the per capita cost is less because of the greater density of residents connected to collection system and treatment. In the Twin Cities metropolitan area, the rates are about one-third. In other words, in greater Minnesota, those rates generally are from $300 to $800 or $900, where in the metropolitan area, the average is about $268 per connection. A very high percentage of Minnesota residents are provided with collection and treatment through a centralized collection and treatment system. However, there's approximately 16% of the residents are on on-site systems that they generally fund themselves. That is, few of those receive grants or low-interest loans for these systems, although there are a few exceptions to that. There's an estimated additional $236 million needed in annual funding beyond the amounts that are currently paid from existing sources of funds. The existing sources of funds include grants, low-interest loans, and revenue paid by residents through rates of service that provide for infrastructure improvements, but a lot of that money goes for the operation and maintenance of those wastewater collection and treatment systems. The rates, and I mentioned this, in greater Minnesota are generally in the $300 to $800 compared to that $268 annually that I mentioned in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. And this difference highlights the greater cost in greater Minnesota versus that in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. How do we raise the grade for the wastewater? With additional funding to the Clean Water Revolving Fund, similar to in the Drinking Water Fund, it would be possible to increase lending capacity provided by this fund. It should be remembered that the issuance of monies that result in the funding of wastewater infrastructure includes the repayment of funds borrowed, in many cases, to repayment those repayment charges from the cities that have received loans or sanitary districts goes back into that revolving fund. The hope was that eventually this would be self-sustaining, but the needs have far exceeded the availability of funds to date. Currently, Clean Water Legacy funds are almost exclusively used for non-point source stormwater projects. We believe the language that created the Clean Water Legacy funds would also include disbursement of these funds for wastewater infrastructure projects. However, that has not occurred. Expenses for the maintenance of wastewater systems are needed in many cases beyond just what can be provided through rates, since in some cases the rates being charged are inadequate to properly fund O&M for these systems. The public needs to understand the implications of underfunding the O&M of wastewater systems. That is, underfunding can result in premature failure of systems that have been constructed to protect our water quality as well as our public health in the state of Minnesota. One of the obvious needs is broader use of asset management as it relates to wastewater systems and possibly many other infrastructure categories we examine in the ASC Minnesota Infrastructure Report Card. I think that's been a theme that everybody that's provided testimony to you has mentioned. The asset management is a plus in evaluating what we need and what we have so we can adequately evaluate what we need going forward.
It is a Martinson.
Yes.
We trust that Representative Hansen's Environment Committee is going to be going into this more in depth than we will go into this. And so let us wind up.
Okay. That's the conclusion of our prepared testimony. If you have any questions, Madam Chair or members of the committee, we'd be happy to try to answer those.
Well, I think Mr. Spihala wants to conclude.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you, committee, for your time. We appreciate the opportunity to present the 2018 Minnesota Infrastructure Report Card.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I asked a question last week of you at the conclusion of the meeting. Just wondered if you had time to look at that. You have expressed a lot of needs in a lot of areas. How much money is this going to take totally to do, covering all of the areas? I don't know if you've looked at it annually or over 20 years or whatever. Do you have any idea?
Mr. Spihala.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, we did go back and we are actually looking at compiling those numbers for you, and we can get back those numbers to the committee and yourself. And if you'd like, it could be either on a year or a 20-year basis.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, you know, both ways would be interesting to look at. I think it's an important number for us to have, so certainly would look forward to receiving it from you. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to note it's really challenging sometimes with the generalizations where it's Greater Minnesota versus Metro, because, and I note that you said generally, but I think Representative Considine reminded me last year in this committee, you know, some of the older first-tier communities in the Metro area may have much, much, much higher water bills than Greater Minnesota. When you aggregate the seven-county Metro townships down by Representative Juergens versus communities like mine, and then contrasting with like Representative Lee's or Representative Dane's, it's very different. And to say that they're three times, Greater Minnesota's are three times higher than the seven county metro doesn't do a service to either. I think it's good to look at actual data on water bills that people pay, and the net effect is that wherever you live in the state, we have an aging infrastructure problem, and we're all paying, and we're all going to pay a lot more. If I went back to my district and said, guess what, your Greater Minnesota colleagues are paying three times more than you. I think they pull out their water bills and show us what the reality is.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Spihalla, and your guests that you brought with us, and your engineer, the engineers that participated, and those that toured the state to draw up the report card. We appreciate your expertise.
You're welcome, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Very welcome. Thank you.
Next item on the agenda is the Minnesota State University System. And Chancellor Malhotra and Mr. Yodelitz, welcome back. And I challenge Chancellor to come before us, and I expect that we will learn a lot from your presentations. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Murphy, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Devinder Malhotra. I'm the Chancellor of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. With me at the table is Brian Yolitz, our Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities. Also joining me in the audience is Trustee Jay Coles, who's the Vice Chair of our Board of Trustees. Thank you again, Chair Murphy and the members of the committee, for the opportunity afforded to us to present to you 2019 capital request and to provide this committee with an update on the progress we have made on the investments you made in our system in 2017 and 2018. In our update, I believe you'll be pleased with our execution of the projects you funded. Representative Erdahl, I want to personally thank you for your steadfast commitment over the years and for your advocacy for higher education. Chair Murphy and members of the committee, my first task is easy today, and it is to thank you for your support you have given Minnesota State and to assure you that we will continue to be your partner in this important work. We look forward to your bonding tours, which will allow you to see firsthand the needs of our campus. But more importantly, you will witness how your investments have allowed Minnesota State to meet the needs of the students we serve and to add to the vibrancy of the communities in which our colleges and universities are located. In your first few hearings, I was struck that several of you made a mention of Minnesota State campuses as key investments that Minnesota has made that made a real difference in transforming the communities you serve. For example, Representative Wolgamott, who knew that 30 years ago, a project at St. Cloud State University in your district will produce the number one hockey team in the nation?
Believe it.
Associate Vice Chancellor, on a previous occasion, had mentioned that Minnesota State's growth began with the passage of the post-World War II GI Bill. Without a doubt, GI Bill was a game changer, for it broadened the middle class by providing opportunities for higher education. 60 years ago, to account for the growth of higher ed fueled by the GI Bill, Minnesota made substantial capital investments in our colleges and universities. These investments made 60 years ago drive our current capital priority, and that is HEPR funding. Let me step back a moment and give the committee a sense of our system and the size and scope of our impact. We educate 375,000 students across the state. Of these 375,000 students, more than 65,000 students come from communities of color or are of the native origin. More than 75,000 are low-income students. More than 80,000 students are 25 years or older. more than 43,000 are first in their family to come to college, 10,000 veterans and active service members, and 118,000 employees in business and industry who take advantage of our continuing education through our customized training programs. This slide represents the impact our colleges and universities have on the workforce development and labor market. 9 out of 10 employed mechanics graduated from our colleges. 9 out of 10 workers in manufacturing graduated from our colleges. 8 out of 10 law enforcement professionals were trained in our colleges and universities. 2 out of 3 nurses were trained in our colleges and universities. 7 out of 10 employed in various trades came and had education from our colleges. 6 out of 10 in agriculture and ag processing are graduates of our colleges and universities. In addition, half of all the teachers, half of all the IT professionals, and half of all the business graduates come from our colleges and universities. Of our 39,000 graduates each year, 87% of them find jobs in their field of study and stay in Minnesota. Chair Murphy, I would like to turn this presentation over to Brian Yolitz, Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities. He has tremendous amount of experience, including a 27-year career in the United States Air Force and already 8 years of service to Minnesota State. Managing an infrastructure portfolio of 843 buildings and 28 million square feet is no small task, and we are very fortunate to have Brian and his colleagues doing this important work. As Brian can tell you in some detail, every one of our campuses has dedicated public servants who make sure that our students, our faculty, and our staff, and the general public who visit us are safe, warm, and dry. As you can imagine, it is no small task to manage our infrastructure, especially when we go through a cold snap like the one we had last week. Chair Murphy, members of the committee, I thank you, and I look forward, as the slide indicates, hanging out with you on your bonding tours in the coming months.
Well, Chancellor, we're looking forward to that also.
Thank you.
Summer's going to be good this year.
Thank you.
Good morning,
Chair Murphy. Good morning, Chair Murphy, members. Thank you for the time this morning. To set the stage, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities operates on 54 campuses in 47 communities around the state of Minnesota. Facilities encompass over 28 million square feet of facility space, including classrooms and labs, residential and dining facilities, recreational and wellness space, and parking ramps. These buildings represent roughly one-third of the state of Minnesota's buildings in their total owned inventory. The estimated replacement value of all of our buildings is just over $10 billion. Doing the math, you would say that the average campus is just over 500,000 square feet or 500,000 square feet. That's roughly 8.5 football fields in size across the state of Minnesota. But in fact, our campus facilities vary dramatically, just like our academic programs and the students we serve. We have 7 campuses with over 1 million square feet of facility space, the largest of which is St. Cloud State University, the Regional Comprehensive University, with a residential residential life programs with 3.2 million square feet of facility space, including academic buildings, research space, residence halls, a football stadium, and, as Chancellor Malhotra mentioned, a hockey arena. We also have 7 campuses with building space totaling 100,000 square feet or less, the smallest of which is the Owatonna campus of Riverland Community College. In terms of facility space, our square footage, 80% is in what considered an academic in nature, with over 2,000 classrooms, 1,600 labs, including your traditional science labs, but also auto repair, stringed instrument repair, wind instrument repair, heavy construction, farm equipment, machining and welding labs, as well as student support services. This space includes faculty and staff offices and plant operations. The academic space is operated and maintained through tuition and state appropriations associated with the individual college or university general funds and are eligible for capital investment and bonding and the bonding process through the work of this committee. 20% of our facility space is in the revenue fund. That space, such as residence halls, major dining facilities, student unions, and major parking ramps. These spaces are operated and maintained through individual college university revenue fund programs and through user fees associated with those individual programs. As Chancellor Malhotra noted earlier, the age and condition of our academic buildings is the major force in our board's approach to strategic capital investments in our infrastructure. Two-thirds of our academic space is over 40 years of age and growing older. Over half the space was built between 1960 and 1980, a period known as for flash construction, where we saw buildings rapidly built with a focus on relatively cheap construction materials, low-quality materials, and where energy efficiency and sustainability were an afterthought in the process. Many of these buildings and their components have reached or are at the ends of their useful lives. As many of you know, this committee was very busy during the 2017 and 2018 legislative sessions. Minnesota received $92.3 million in the 2017 legislative session, including some $25 million for HEPR and $67 million, which funded seven major capital projects. As a bit of an update on those projects, the projects that funded the STEM and healthcare renovation at the North Mankato campus of South Central College is through the design process, is now through the bidding and into construction. The community matching funds are in place at M-State Fergus Falls for the Student and Workforce Success Project, and we're moving forward with that work. And finally, the library renovation at Wadena campus is complete, and we've had a ribbon cutting, and the students are enjoying that space right now. In addition, up at Northland Community College in East Grand Forks, the laboratory renovation is complete, and three major renovation, quite frankly, transformational projects for the campus at Hibbing, Winona State University's Education Village, and St. Cloud State University's Eastman's Halls are nearing completion, and we expect ribbon cutting in the coming months with grand opening ceremonies happening very shortly. We will inform the committee and local members of the opportunity to participate in those events. We're excited to see what your funding has done and how they transform those institutions. The 2018 bonding bill provided some $129 million for our college universities, including $45 million for HEPR and $84 million for 10 major capital projects. The design funding that was provided in prior bonding bills enabled projects at Bemidji State, Rochester, and Mankato to swiftly move into construction. I recognize several faces from the groundbreaking last fall at Rochester Community College on a crisp morning with some good cake and conversation with people. Design work is underway at the projects at Anoka Ramsey and Century College, and when design work is ready, we'll be seeking construction funding for the Anoka Ramsey project in the future bonding bill. Turning to the Normandale project, MSU Moorhead, Inverhills, and Albert Lee campus of Riverland Community College and Fond du Lac, those are all deep in their design processes. Of note, the project at Normandale and Riverland are being constructed or executed through a strategy called Construction Manager at Risk. We've got the general contractor on board finalizing designs of those major renovation projects. We plan to seek funding for Normandale's classroom renovation phase two, as well as construction funding for MSU Moorhead, Inverhill, and Inverhills in future bonding bills. Turning our attention to HEPR, the HEPR funding in 2017 allowed us to begin more than 30 priority projects at our colleges and universities. Of these, 16 are complete and 10 are on their way to be completed this summer and being ready for students next fall, making conditions better on campuses. Six were for design of major and substantial renovation and replacement projects that need to be funded in the future, specifically the HVAC replacement in Alexandria, the roof replacements at Itasca and MSU Moorhead, and the repair of the Skyway over Hennepin Avenue at MCTC, and the tunnel and drainage repairs at Normandale College. I think some members remember seeing some of the water running down the walls in that space. And then finally, interior work at Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College. Those are all being prepared for future funding. And that happened in 2018. Those projects were funded for construction along with as part of the $45 million that were received. Of those, of that funding we received, another 21 projects were started, 9 of which are in design, 10 of which are out for bid right now for construction. It'll be starting earlier this spring as soon as students leave campus. And then finally, one project at Winona State University, their Cathedral Hall roof, is already complete. While the funding in 2017 and 18 bonding bills have been very helpful, there's more to the asset preservation story to tell. Between recent bonding years, Minnesota State has requested $460 million for asset preservation through HEPR as their number one priority in our capital requests for our college and universities. These requests were to address the most urgent college university needs for campus building, exterior repairs, including roofs, windows, doors and exterior brickwork, heating and cooling system upgrades, and utility and energy systems management systems. These requests were built on a capital investment strategy that called for our college universities to invest $1 a square foot, with the state of Minnesota providing asset preservation funding through HEPR. Minnesota State has received a total of $132 million in HEPR funding through all of the bonding years between 2012 and 2018, or less than 30% of the requested amount needed to address the urgent preservation needs of our college university buildings, the ones we already have. This level of HEPR funding has led to many preservation needs going unmet. As a result, we've seen the backlog of maintenance and the cost of those buildings, systems, and components that have exceeded their useful lives grow by over 40% since 2012. Our aging buildings and infrastructure only add to the problem. The anticipated preservation needs over the next 10 years, as we look forward, totals roughly $1.3 billion, making the total cost of both backlog of maintenance and anticipated preservation needs for the coming 10 years to over $2 billion. This situation led to our board to seek $150 million in HEPR funding in the 2019 legislative session. Given the conditions and priorities of our campuses at the beginning of the session, this funding would allow for over 70 priority asset preservation projects to go forward. The work is focused predominantly on roofs and HVAC systems and would directly impact the conditions on over 40 campuses in every corner of the state. Admittedly, these are not very glamorous projects with amazing architectural renderings and sketchings, but these are what our college universities urgently need. This list is a sampling of the work that would be accomplished with this request. At Bemidji State, their electrical system would be upgraded to be more compliant with and more reliable. The roofs and boilers at Century College would be replaced. Roofs at Lake Superior College would be addressed, as would the exterior and waterproofing issues at MSU Mankato. Similarly, the building envelope issues at RCTC would be taken care of, as would fire alarm and HVAC upgrades would happen at St. Cloud Technical and Community College. These, along with so many other issues, would be addressed at Minnesota State College and Universities through this funding and asset preservation. Chair Murphy and committee, the men and women charged with taking care of the buildings and infrastructure where our important teaching and learning happen, take their stewardship responsibility seriously. It's evident in how each and every one of our campuses is running and how they look when our students arrive on the first day of class. And when funds are provided, how efficiently and effectively they execute the projects with the money that provided them. We're thankful for the past attention and support of this committee. More is needed to deliver on the stewardship responsibility of the buildings entrusted by all Minnesotans to us. That's what our request for 2019 is focused on. $150 million to fix roofs and components of buildings that we already have to keep them warm, safe, and dry for our students, faculty, and staff. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for your time and attention this morning. We can stand for any questions.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe you said it and I missed it, but what is the total number of buildings that are owned by our colleges and universities?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, it's right around
843.
That's correct.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
You have your 2019 request at $150 million. I don't have any idea what our number might come up with at the end of this year. But historically, the first year of the biennium is the smaller bonding year. I mean, $150 million, you know, might be half of the entire bill if that's what we did. I'm wondering if the if we so we didn't do a large bonding bill this year, didn't nearly match what you're looking for here. Your request next year, which is the the bigger, larger funding year, would that be similar to this? Or if you didn't get $150 million this year, how would it affect what you ask for next year?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl.
Chancellor.
We would anticipate that we're going to need sustained asset preservation funding over several biennium to get us in the shape that we need to buy down the backlog and address the coming amount of funds. I would expect, although our board has not made a position yet on the 2020 capital request, I would expect that they would continue to keep a high priority and request for asset preservation on the same order that you see in this request today. If you look, I believe, I'm going to go back a second if you don't mind. What hurt us was relatively low HEPR funding in the 2012. I know there wasn't a bonding bill in 2013, but there was a bonding bill in 15. There was no HEPR funding. As you know, Representative Erdahl, no bonding bill in 2016. There was no HEPR money there. That really, really hurt not only Minnesota State College universities, but all state agencies in the asset preservation fight. And so we've got an uphill battle, and I think that we, along with others, are going to continue to seek additional funding and support in that area.
Madam Chair, if I could just say,
Representative Erdahl.
But then came the last 2 years.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, indeed, that's a nice trend we have started in the green. Please continue to move it up.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. Slide 9. Campus facilities, the revenue funds, those all draw revenue. Do they break even? The revenue that they get, what percentage of the funds do they make for this?
Chancellor Yola.
Madam Chair, Representative Constantine, indeed, those all are self-fund. They make all their payments. They pay their debt service as well as their operating expenses. That no operating dollars transfer into the revenue fund programs.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. Is there a depreciation fund then for these where they are putting money aside to replace the facilities?
Madam Chair, Representative Considine, indeed, that's part of their operating budget. They have a performa that marches out and assess what are their asset preservation needs going to be. So when they have to do a repair of a roof, they've already built that in their fee structure and the model that we pay, charge students and users of our facilities, whether it's board fees for their residence halls or the fees that are associated with parking ramps. It's all built into the financial model for that facility.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your answer.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Vice Chancellor and Chancellor. As I'm looking at the sort of life of the buildings that were built between the 60s and 70s, you have a significant amount of building stock that's probably exceeded its life as originally designed. And when I look at the funding history and the deferred maintenance growth, I see a graph that appears to be entering a state of exponentially growing, and I think about your ask every year or every couple years, and I'm not so sure that the state's going to be able to take care of all of that in the future. So I'm curious, as you have conversations, what are those conversations like? How do you reduce the operations of costs? I've noticed you've replaced a lot of roofs. And my question is, how many of those roofs now have solar panels on them to address some of the ongoing energy costs that are going to be associated with those buildings? So if you could just speak to that a little bit. you know, I mean, I've only had a little time in front of this, and I'm sure you guys have thought about this in great depth on what that future looks like.
Mr. Yoletz.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, indeed, we recognize that we've got an aging infrastructure stock and recognize and have taken action at times to realize that the building has outlived its useful life. The example, the greatest example, I think, and the most transformative one, that we're actually saying we're going to quit just fixing up, we're going to replace. We're replaced with a smaller, more effective footprint. Bemidji State University, we're tearing down Hague Sauer Hall. And some are like, you know, I went to school there, and there's some concerns, but we're replacing it in its entirety with a brand new facility, smaller footprint. There will be some renewable energy associated with that, as well as some water management functions. So we're doing that in small bites. We're in the current. I haven't taken to my boss yet recommendations for the 2020 capital request. But in amongst that, it are several projects that take entire facilities down and replace them because they're no longer effective in their current operation. And no matter how much we invest in them, we're just going to have an old, tired building. We are looking at other places where we can simply just demolish buildings that are no longer needed because of the way our pedagogy is transformed, the way we teach students is no longer, some of the space is no longer effective. Another example is Rochester Community and Technical College. We're demolishing two spaces there that had the concrete tiered classrooms, and we just don't teach like that anymore. So we're removing that and making a conscious effort to live within a smaller, more effective footprint. Did you want anything?
Chair Murphy, Representative Dean.
Chancellor.
Yeah, Chair Murphy, the only thing I would add is that you're absolutely right. I mean, I think there are two elements as we redesign our, as we move forward and as we reimagine and redesign our teaching and learning activities, we need to redesign and rethink our building structures too. Because who our students are and how they learn is also changing very dramatically. And so we have our hands full in rethinking. But as Associate Vice Chancellor Yoletz pointed out, as we move forward, we'll have a smaller footprint, more effective buildings, and better designs.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Associate Vice Chancellor Yoletz and Chancellor Malhotra, thank you for coming today. And one of my questions that I was, or comments that I was going to make, you just addressed it. And on the bonding tours, there were two things that really stood out to me with both the University of Minnesota as well as the MinSCU system. And one of them was just exactly that, when you would show us how by remodeling a building, you'd be actually increase the usable square footage to become more efficient. And that was one of the things that stood out to me when we were visiting the schools. And then the other one, and I believe it was at Riverland Community College in Albert Lee, when you brought in the business community and said, if you expand this program, if you train them, we will hire them. We need them. And that, Madam Chair, I think is something we need to also keep in mind from an economic development standpoint. So those are two things. I appreciate you showing us those on the tours before, and they were both, I think, very effective.
Representative Narnas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question. This street listing, the 2019 capital request, are these projects is there a preference? Are they, is there a priority up to this list, or is it just a list?
Vice Chancellor.
Madam Chair, Representative Narnas, that's, if we were to get $150 million today, that's the slot of projects that we would fund. I know in the past there's been, what if you got $100 million or whatever, and that's a drill that we would do. We would look at and touch base with campuses and provide a list to the committee should that happen. But our request right now is for $150 million for asset preservation, and that's what we would address with the funding should it be made available today.
Representative Considine.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I waved it off, but as long as you called on me, You did mention Armstrong Hall at Minnesota State Mankato being torn down and redone. I went to class there in 1976, and it was an old, dilapidated building then.
Madam Chair, Trustee, Representative Constantine, indeed, that's one of the projects we're considering at this time, would be the demolition of that. Also, at MSU Mankato, we did demolish Gage Hall and provided a far better residential life in the revenue fund for our students there.
Thank you very much. Your request has been presented, and we will take it under consideration as we go along, as we find out more details about what's to come and what happens in 2019. So far, we haven't heard much. But we're going to by the end of the month, I understand. Representative Salt, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you're familiar with my approach to some of these things, I don't mind asking you an uncomfortable question, and so I'll continue with my history that way. In terms of asking if you have considered a new paradigm or a different paradigm relative to the assets used and how you get them. So in Rochester, we have the grand experiment going on as to the facility running in purely leased space. That is a complete change of the paradigm of how to own and or maintain resources. I'm only interested in that you watch it and maybe you have already and are watching the financials. I know it's a sister facility and a sister organization, and they're going to be here someplace to report, hopefully, on that particular financial model. But I think that it is something that warrants very clear and direct consideration as you are rotating through your building stock, which is so many buildings that I would think there could be an advantage, although I certainly do not sit in your chair and I don't envy that at all. So I don't know if you have any comments on that.
Vice Chancellor Yolitz.
Madam Chair, Representative Salk, yes, we do have some lease spaces that we watch our colleagues and their strategies in terms of lease facilities, and we've got some leased spaces as well, particularly for upper division coursework. We've got MSU Mankato has a presence at 7700 France for their graduate studies, as does St. Cloud State University, I think in
Metropolitan.
Yep, in Metropolitan State University has a distributed learning network in a lot of leased spaces. And we also do, before we come to build, particularly at several of our colleges, we seek a demonstration of the program sustainability itself. For example, at Lake Superior College, we've got a welding program that they had initially come and said, hey, we want to build a new space for a welding program. And we said, well, why don't you go prove a concept? So they went downtown Duluth, leased space, and have now got a cohort and a waiting list. So they've built a model that says, hey, we've got a demand, and now we're trying to do the math on the return on investment, and over the long term, is it better for us to bring that operation in-house, on campus, in own space? But indeed, we're exploring that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your input.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Murphy, members of the committee.
The minutes of the meeting are before us.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes that are before us.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Moves that we adopt the minutes as printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Lilly. University of Minnesota is next on our list. Welcome to the committee. Please begin.
Good morning, Chair Murphy and members of the committee. I'm Brian Burnett. I'm the Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations of the University of Minnesota, and it's my pleasure to be here with you this morning. And we appreciate the opportunity to present to you. The university, as you may know, is the state's land-grant and research university. and is the eighth-ranked public research university in the United States in terms of research productivity. We have 67,000 students, 26,000 employees, and we're one of the six top employers in the state, returning about $8 billion to the Minnesota economy each year in the work that we do. That's come about through strong support from the Minnesota legislature over decades, if not over a century, of support of the university, and we're very grateful. So we'd like to thank you for that support and talk to you about the impact that our facilities have on the mission of the university. Minnesotans are the beneficiaries of our strong legacy, and for the university's legacy and impact in Minnesota to remain strong, our students, our researchers, our patients, our visitors, and educators require not only adequate but modern and useful spaces for research, learning, and outreach. We are focused on maintaining support for our state's future leaders, research, and communities. And the projects you see are the culmination of a six-year planning process that is reviewed system-wide and updated annually. This request this year does not include funding for new buildings. Our priorities are focused and strategic, concentrating on maintaining and maximizing the usefulness of the current facilities across the state and our four campuses that have owned buildings, with one campus, as Representative Spock noted, with all leased buildings in Rochester. The use request demonstrates financial stewardship. Our capital request is fiscally responsible, demonstrating smart stewardship of past state investment. And we're making very good progress on spending prior appropriations granted to the university. 100% of our HEPR appropriated before 2014 are fully spent or encumbered. 98% of the 2014 to 2018 HEPR funds are spent, encumbered, or otherwise obligated. And major projects from 2017, all in construction, and those from 2018 are advancing well through design. And Chair Murphy, we very much appreciate your longstanding support of UMD. We wanted you to know that UMD is part of our presentation today, but UMD officials were unable to be with us this morning. So as system officials, Vice President Bertelson and I will be presenting on behalf of UMD this morning.
And Ms. Williams assures me that she'll be in later in the week.
That's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair. So just briefly on speaking of UMD, the 2017 bonding projects to bring you up to date. The Heikkila Chemistry and Advanced Materials Science Building at UMD was important because the largest enrollment growth at Duluth is in our science and engineering programs. This facility allows us to better meet that demand, provide quality STEM education, and drive the workforce in northern Minnesota. The project was designed to promote collaboration by mixing faculty, research, and teaching spaces together. Keys and ownership have been turned over to UMD. We're still furnishing and doing some finishing touches. A ribbon cutting was held on January 18th, but the official grand opening will be in this summer, with classes beginning this fall. The project was on time and on budget, and we're very grateful for the state's $42.4 million and the university provided, with the help of the Heikkila family, $28.2 million for this invaluable project to the Duluth campus. Second on our list in the middle picture is the Health Sciences Education Center, and this project will renovate and build a new Health Sciences Education Center along the eastern facade of Phillips Wangenstein Building on the Twin Cities East Bank campus. This project focuses on the construction of a new seven-story building and interior renovation of three floors within Phillips Wangenstein. Of note, we took down two buildings of 125,000 square feet, the old VFW and Masonic, saving the university estimated about $32 million in capital needs. So to the earlier point with our colleagues at Minnesota State, we actually took down two buildings, replacing with the building before you, to build an entirely new state-of-the-art where we're going to train the next generation of doctors, nurses, dentists, and pharmacists for the state of Minnesota. This total project will incorporate active learning classrooms, simulation, knowledge management with the library, student services, as well as a variety of student study spaces, and interprofessional lounge and event space and cafe, because we know modern healthcare involves interprofessional working together, nurses, doctors, pharmacists, for the next generation of healthcare. The demolition and renovation of Phillips Wangenstein's second and third and fifth floors are virtually complete. The construction is completed, and we are estimating to complete in December of this year. The state provided $66.6 million, and the university is providing $33.3 million. This is a $100 million project and vital to the medical school and all of our health sciences on the East Bank campus. And finally, on the right, the Plant Growth Research Facility. This project will construct a new greenhouse addition to the Plant Growth Facility's West Greenhouse District on our St. Paul campus for the College of Biological Sciences Conservatory. I believe Representative Erdahl joined us last October for the groundbreaking of this project. And this new greenhouse will be furnished with modern temperature, humidity, and lighting controls. Four separate biome environments will be created to include conservatory space for students, research, and public access, and each will be monitored via the master greenhouse campus control system. This project's also under construction, with our completion expected in April of this year. And the funding from the state, we're very grateful for the $6.6 million that matched $2.2 million from the university for this important project. With respect to the 2018 bonding projects, Pillsbury Hall, the second oldest building on the Twin Cities campus, in fact, it's building number two, was constructed in 1889 and is located within our humanities district. Pillsbury Hall will now be repositioned to provide a home for the Department of English, currently occupied in Lind Hall, or home of our College of Science and Engineering. Their new location supports a broader academic vision for the College of Liberal Arts and the Humanities District, and is anticipated to complement other CLA programs within the district. This project is currently in schematic design, with construction completion expected in summer of 2021. We're grateful for the state's $24 million, which will match $12 million for the state for this $36 million project for Pillsbury Hall. Next, in Crookston and Morris, we're grateful for academic renewal projects for improvements in four buildings at Crookston and Morris, in Dowell Hall, Owen Hall at Crookston, and Blakely Hall in the Humanities Building at Morris. This modest investment will create modern teaching and research spaces for our students, and the state was grateful enough to, we were grateful enough to get $6.4 million for these projects, while the university provided $3.2 million. And finally, Glensheen, in the 2018 bonding bill, for those of you not aware, Glensheen is a 7.6-acre estate on the shores of Lake Superior, built by the Congdon family from 1905 to 1908. The 2018 Glensheen capital request included funding for four projects: site structures, including terraces and garden walls, boiler replacement and a heating system, manor house improvements, carriage house improvements, and the state appropriation is contingent on the university contributing an equal amount from other sources. So for the $4 million from the state, we're working on finding the other $4 million to do about $8 million worth of projects for this. So that's a recap of the 2018 bonding projects. For the next part of the university's presentation, Madam Chair, with your permission, I'll ask Vice President of University Services, Mike Burleson.
Mr. Burnett, just can we go back to the second picture?
Sure.
The health science building. You said that you took down two buildings?
Yes, ma'am.
Were they on university land?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And they were what?
I went through that fairly fast. It was called the VFW and the Masonic Building. They were partly gifted to the university years and years ago. I believe in the 1950s or 60s was their vintage. But they had about $32 million in capital needs. So when the Health Sciences Education Center was envisioned, the idea was to take those buildings down and put a new building in its place, so that you didn't need to do the renovation of those buildings. Let's just take them out, tie it into the Phillips Wangenstein Building that you can see behind. And so this building actually ties into those towers right behind as part of that project.
When the buildings were occupied, the two buildings that you took down, when they were occupied previously, did they serve the university or did they serve the community?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, they served the university, and I could ask Vice President Burleson, they were probably underutilized would be a better case. A lot of things had been moved out over the years, but they were even though they had the name VFW and Masonic, and maybe that's the confusion, they were university-owned buildings on university-owned land.
Okay.
Vice President
that's
Burleson?
Correct. And it became available to be demolished. through a series of plans. When we built the new clinical and surgery center, most of those programs moved into that building, and others were relocated within other spaces at the institution.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it.
So with that, I'd like to ask Vice President Bertelsen, with your permission, to talk about the HEPA report.
Representative Salt.
For the benefit of understanding why Glen Sheen and Pillsbury have significance that is greater than the financial delta between that and some other facility that would have efficiency, energy, it'd have all kinds of improvements, yet these two stand as somehow being significant, that we as a culture or we as a society want to carry that delta for the benefit of them being restored and continued in the. Can you talk a bit about, and I know that's a, some people have written, you know, great discourses on this particular question, that sort of thing. If is there anything that's relatively compact as an answer to why do we keep old things like this around?
Because. Mr. Burnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, members of the committee, it's Minnesota's history. Pillsbury Hall, I would submit to you, is probably one of the most iconic, if not the most iconic, structure in our entire university system. John Pillsbury, who paid for the building, not only founded a company that still bears his name, was governor of the state of Minnesota, regent of the University of Minnesota, president of the University of Minnesota. Not too many people have made that trifecta in the history of the state, and when you think about that iconic building for every student that's ever been on the Twin Cities campus, I can't imagine a scenario where the university would think about operating the University of Minnesota without Pillsbury Hall. Now, with the Tate Hall, we were able to move out quickly. We were able to move out the health sciences. It's the perfect home for the English department. And so in that regard, I guess you would talk, it is a little bit more expensive, but I think preserving Minnesota history is also part of the goal of the University of Minnesota, especially important history, some of it speaks Pillsbury. With respect to Glen Sheen, this was a gift to the Regents back in the 60s. From the Duluth area, and while it doesn't have as big of an academic impact because it doesn't sit on the Duluth campus or one of our five campuses, it's still very important to St. Louis County, to the history of Duluth, and our work as stewards of that gift are to ensure that we can keep that in the best shape possible. So we think a measured request of around $4 million for Glen Sheen was the right answer for something that has some attendant educational mission for our students. But clearly, back to Pillsbury Hall, that'll be the heart of all English classes for the next 50 years or more for all the students. And I would submit to you, most students on our campuses, especially the Twin Cities campus, have some form of English as part of their curriculum, no matter what discipline they're studying. So I guess what I would say is it's preserving history, it's honoring our legacy, and it's vitally important in the Pillsbury case to the undergraduate and graduate mission of our university.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, I appreciate that answer. I think you expressed it very well. As someone who has long been a historical preservationist of historic buildings, I appreciated your commitment to Pillsbury Hall, not just the building itself, but as you expressed, the need for the English department to actually have a structure of that type. Regarding Glen Sheen, I actually helped to negotiate what was going to happen there. You know, certainly an iconic building regarding the history of Minnesota, the history of the North Shore and Duluth, and important to maintain, especially in light of the fact that there were serious needs to do something to avoid, you know, further degradation of the building itself. It was there are parts of the estate that were literally falling apart, and something needs to be done. And so you know, hopefully you'll come up with the other $4 million before too long, and they can get on with doing what is vital to be done.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Riddle. We're working on that plan to raise that other $4 million, and we appreciate the support of that project.
I think this is an anecdote. The first time I went to Glen Sheen was with Regent Goldfein shortly after it was gifted to the university, and we toured on a cold day. But the most impressive thing, Representative Salk, was went up into the attic, and there was all these old rolled-up Persian carpets. And then there was, over in the corner, a stack of National Geographics from the beginning of time. And then next to the National Geographics were blue books from the legislature from when Chester Congdon served and before, the years before Chester Congdon served at the legislature. And so there was the blue book stack wasn't as large as the National Geographic stack, but that's what impressed me so much. And I still remember that day and what a gift it was. And you'll see when we're on our tour and we have s'mores on the sea, down on the waterfront. Yes.
Ms. Chair, I sort of framed it and put the emphasis on purpose. What I'm really interested in, and I think I've been part of preservation in Rochester, and one of the things that I'm most disappointed in is oftentimes we use these facilities and treat them like a Christmas present in that, ooh, I got this wonderful thing, and then that thing has its place on the shelf or in the box or wherever, and it isn't made real in the daily life of the person who received that. And that's what I was fishing for, and I probably should have just said it, is I wish and I hope that we have purposeful, content-laden presentation of this into the real lives of Minnesota and, of course, the students and faculty that are there. But I think that is oftentimes lost and missed. We have these wonderful buildings in Rochester from the Mayo family and that sort of thing. And it sometimes the building gets included in the community's function, and sometimes it just sits on the hill and looks beautiful. And I think there's a real difference in how we treat these things as to that margin that I was trying to lay out. Is there's a calculated loss of funds that in terms of what you might otherwise use. But if we put some use to that building in terms of cultural improvement and understanding of where we are in history, those kinds of things, that's when we get back that margin of difference in the finance.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've been lucky enough to tour Glen Sheen a couple different times, and I think it really is an asset to the state and clearly to Duluth, but really the state and all of us. But Representative Juergens kind of captured some of this in some of his comments earlier about what impacted him on other tours. But you know, that, for me, that it was the jobs kind of component that you have going on there. You really incorporated the students in the activities there, the tours, the you know, the just working there. And I just think it's a great opportunity that you've kind of figured out and took it to the next level. That gentleman that's operating, I think, is actually making money or close to it or something on the facility. But I really I'm looking forward to the tour. But it's to me, yes, the building's great, but also to see what the students, what you've been able to figure out with the students. And I mean, those are life skills that are just any career that they go into, being able to talk to people and those sort of things are priceless.
Next on the agenda is Mr. Bertelsen. Welcome home.
Thank you.
You're now Vice President at the university. We're so proud.
I had good training from a long time ago, Representative Murphy. I will try to speed up a little bit some of the summary information you've already understood about HEPR. You know what it is. I don't need to tell you about that. We have done, just wanted to assure you that we are putting your appropriations for HEPR at work. 98% of that, the things from 2014 to 2018 are spent, encumbered, or otherwise obligated. Across 110 projects, 85 buildings across the state in 27 counties and 59 cities, over 90% of that into Minnesota architects, engineers, and contractors.
though, and that's important, and we're making progress, and we're ready to put every penny to work that you give us. And we have a $200 million list of projects, which are our priority out of $4.5 billion worth of identified need. So we know that's important, and we're ready to go to spend some more. Thank you. Our 2019 capital request includes, as I said, the $200 million for Heaper, as well as the child development building replacement and renovation in Duluth at A.B. Anderson Hall, which we'll talk about in a moment. Of the Heaper projects themselves, we use an allocation formula that's based on both campus size and facility condition. We use a third-party inspector to identify what projects, and then within that, following that list of identified needs, we look at the criticality of buildings, how bad is the problem, what's the risk to people and program, what's a regulatory impact, and how significant is any downside impact to program that may occur as well. That $200 million, as I said, includes over 200 critical projects in over 100 buildings. And so next we'll talk about the Institute for Child Development. This $28 million in state funds request just to pre-design, design, and renovate, construct, and furnish, and to really reimagine the Institute for Child Development facility for the University of Minnesota College of Education and Human Development building on the East Bank campus of the Twin Cities campus. East Bank of the Twin Cities campus. The current Institute for Child Development building lacks both the right kind of space and basic infrastructure needs to support the Institute's core academic and research operations, and I will turn it over to Megan Gunner, the chair of the Institute for Child Development, to tell you about their program.
Ms. Gunner. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Murphy, and the members of the committee for bringing us here today to tell you a bit about our needs and help you understand why this renovated building is so critical. As Vice President Bertelsen said, the university is asking $28 million in state funds for the Institute of Child Development facility. This is part of the University of Minnesota's College of Education and Human Development, and it sits on the east bank of the Twin Cities campus. The total project cost is $42 million. We are raising $14 million, or one-third of that, through development efforts at the university. The Institute of Child Development was founded in 1925. It houses the number one ranked program in child and adolescent psychology in the country, and it is the state's leading program in training early childhood educators. The research we're doing informs educational practice, interventions to improve the emotional, physical, and behavioral health of children and adolescents, and to help parents and professionals who work with children understand what they need in order to be successful. We have close relationships with numerous community organizations, both in the Twin Cities and in Greater Minnesota. We are conducting 21st century science that not only examines children's behavior, but in a sense lifts the hood and looks into the brain architecture, into genetics and physiology to understand how children develop, what goes wrong when development goes off track, and what we can do to get it back on track using 21st century developmental science, which is technology dependent and requires a building that will support that technology. The current Institute building lacks both safe space and basic infrastructure to support our core academic and research operations. Our research rooms are woefully outdated and cannot accommodate the 21st century technology we need for our work. In addition, there's no central air in half of our building, the part that was built in 1913, and we literally have electrodes sliding off children as they sweat when we test them during the summer. The renovated Institute building will allow us to maintain our status as a world leader, provide us with modern research space that will attract and keep leading edge researchers, and will provide the classroom and meeting space we need for our students, faculty, and community partners. Finally, we'll all be able to come home. Currently, to meet our research needs, our testing rooms are spread out across campus. By bringing us all home into the new building, this will support the uniquely collaborative working conditions that have always been part of the Institute's history. Now, thank you for listening to me, and I'd like to turn it over briefly to two of our faculty who will give you an idea, I hope, of not only their research, but why a new building is so important to support it. So this is Jed Ellison and Kathleen Thomas, and I'm going to sit back here.
Thank you, Ms. Gunner. Mr. Ellison.
Good morning, Chair Murphy, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to tell you about some of the work I do on autism spectrum disorder and the importance of a renovated building for the work that I do. Autism exacts a substantial burden on families, emotional and financial. The cost of care to rear a child with or an individual with autism can exceed $3 million over a lifetime. And we expect the costs borne by the United States in whole to exceed or approach $1 trillion with a T by 2025. 1 in 42 individuals with autism, or individuals in Minnesota, has a diagnosis with autism. We know that early intensive behavioral interventions work, but unfortunately, very few children receive a diagnosis in infancy or toddlerhood. Most children diagnosed with autism receive that diagnosis around 5.5 or 6 years of age when children enter kindergarten. We have to do better for the families of children with autism in the state of Minnesota, and this motivates my work. In one line of research, we're testing a new approach to population-based screening in 18 to 24-month-olds through a large federally funded project. And I just learned a couple of weeks ago that we received funding to actually test a similar approach in 6 to 9-month-olds. In another line of research, we use MRI technology to identify patterns of brain development in 6-month-olds that predict whether that child will go on to develop autism at age 2. A third line of active research in my lab is taking this information and developing new personalized interventions for young infants and toddlers at risk for developing autism. The work my colleagues and I do is technology dependent. I cannot effectively conduct my research in the current institute building. Indeed, my research group utilizes borrowed space on the St. Paul campus, which adds about 30 minutes or 30 to 45 minutes of transit time for my students, undergraduate and graduate trainees, transiting between the Twin Cities campus and meetings with me and St. Paul campus for research sessions with families. In the proposed building, I would be able to bring my research back to the Institute, bring my whole team in one space under one roof. The building will have the appropriate soundproofing and electrically shielded rooms that are needed for some of the work that I do, and we'll have separate waiting rooms for families with children with autism that will be very important for my work as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Thomas.
Good morning, Chair Murphy and members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Thomas. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota, and I'm here today to support, to express my support for the Institute of Child Development Bonding Project. By way of background, my research at the ICD examines brain development and cognitive and emotional skills in typically developing children and adolescents. Specifically, I ask how genetics and biological background, as well as unique life experiences, influence a child's brain development and subsequently their long-term achievement and mental health. I'm especially interested in adolescence. Adolescence is a period of both growth and vulnerability, and my research examines how brain development influences risk-taking and mental health outcomes, and how the risks that teens take affect their brain development. To give you one example, my lab is part of a large national study of the impact of alcohol, marijuana, and other substances on the adolescent brain. We know that if we see brain differences in kids who use substances, it could be due to negative impacts of those substances themselves, but it could also be due to differences in their brain from birth, genetic background. So it's really important that we have genetically informed studies to be able to address whether or not substance use in adolescence is particularly toxic. Identical twins have genetically similar brains, but often those twins differ in how early and how often they use substances. So this is a great method for trying to understand the relative importance of genetic background and specific experiences on brain development. So we're using these differences among twins to understand whether what we're seeing is due to the substance use itself or to pre-existing genetic differences. Almost 700 Minnesota youth are participating in this study, which follows them for 10 years from age 9 to 19. They come to our labs to complete many different cognitive and emotional tests, and we scan or image their brains at 5 separate time points at the university's imaging center. In total, our group will be conducting and analyzing more than 3,500 brain scans for this study alone. We struggle to do this kind of work in the current institute building, as Dr. Ellison mentioned. In my lab alone, heavy ceiling tiles randomly drop on students in my lab. My colleague in the lab next door can't run the air conditioning in his lab, which is a window air conditioner, without blowing out the power in my lab. My primary lab space has only 2 usable electrical outlets in a room with 10 computer workstations. And we have expensive and high-end brain imaging equipment that's sensitive to environmental conditions, but we can't maintain a consistent temperature in our building. We're asking for your support for a renovation and expansion of our building to help maintain and grow our number one ranked department into the next century. I appreciate your support of the university and our work, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Burnett, Vice President Burnett, Vice President Bertelsen, welcome back.
Thank you. Our final project, members of the committee, Madam Chair, is the A.B. Anderson Hall renovation project on our Duluth campus and was introduced in last year's bonding bill but was not funded. Anderson Hall was constructed in 1969 and is in need of upgrades to include mechanical systems, life safety systems, and architectural finishes. Located in the central portion of our UMD campus, it provides teaching space for the Departments of Communication, Philosophy, History, and Art. The bottom floor is comprised of fine art studios, kilns, art workspaces, while floors 2 through 4 are occupied by academic offices as well as 10 classrooms. Due to poor air circulation, UMD has had to cancel classes at this facility as it can get extremely uncomfortable heat levels in this room, these rooms. The project will modernize 35,000 square feet of heavily utilized teaching space to provide a more reliable and productive experience for UMD students. And for those in the room that may not know, the UMD campus has about 12,000 students all total studying and learning on our campus. The budget for this project is about $6.4 million, and we were asking for $4.3 million from the state to match $2.1 that the university would provide to complete the project. So again, members of the committee, we thank you for your time this morning, and we appreciate the opportunity to present our highest needs for HEPR, for the Institute for Child Development, and for the A.B. Anderson Project on our Duluth campus for your consideration this session.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for highlighting on here that 90% of your expenditures are being used on Minnesota architects, engineers, and contractors. And I just want to make a general statement to you and to Minnesota State, and I have shared this with staff from MMB too, that I will hope that, you know, the University of Minnesota State will adopt some of our hiring goals with regards to some of the public investment that we're going to be giving, and especially out of the 232, 167 of that is coming onto the Twin Cities campus, and that's right next to my district and right next to some of our members around here too. And so we will, it is my hope that you will work with, you know, the different vendors that we have around the region and really hire them and see how we could use this public investment to really support our communities here and throughout the state of Minnesota, too.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. And and presenting your requests.
Thank you, Representative Murphy, members of the committee. Have a great day.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.